Hey, y'all, how's it going? Oh, that's good. Welcome to the show. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Hope y'all had a good weekend. Today on the show, Joshua Hughes is going to be on to talk a little bit about that project down in Costa Rica. And maybe we'll find out whether our contest winner has taken his vacation yet and how that went. I hadn't heard back. But Joshua Hughes, he's got some things going on. We're going to hear about him. Yeah, if you want. And then also, Keegan Stephan is going to be on the show today. And, you know, I've kind of had a little bit of a problem in that, I know a few good expert witnesses on the domestic police state, Will Grigg, John Whitehead. I really should have a radio relationship with Radley Balco here. He does a lot of great work. I just never have gotten around to interviewing him, really, I guess. He did some stuff that he ought to win the Pulitzer for about the bite mark expert testimony racket that will blow your mind. I mean, seriously, it's really something, man, that Radley Balco. But anyway, what I've always wanted, and, you know, Will Grigg doesn't fit this bill. He writes these, you know, incredible pieces with all this insight and wisdom and all that kind of thing. But what I need is something more bare bones where someone will just come on the show and update us every week on all the different people that cops killed. And so I think I found my guy now. Keegan Stephan. I follow him on Twitter, and he's just on top of all of this stuff. And it's such a deluge. You know, I was talking with a friend of mine who hadn't been paying that close of attention to this stuff, but basically, he'd been paying TV news, levels of attention. And he said to me, yeah, man, I mean, this is getting to be a real problem when every few months or so, cops are killing innocent people like this. And I says to him, I says, wow, you really don't know that this happens every day. Every day. And it's nothing new. The only thing that's new is the disgrace of Mike Brown's body left in the street all day in the sun after he was murdered by Darren Wilson, the liar and coward. They didn't even cover him with a blanket. They just left him there baking in the sun all day long. And then when a few people gathered around, they called out the freaking 3rd Infantry Division to put down the riot that didn't even exist. And the entire world said, wow, it looks like Fallujah in St. Louis. And so finally there was a cause celeb enough to break into the news cycle. There was one egregious enough that the national news of these police killings finally broke from Facebook and Twitter onto TV news. That's what's new. That's what's new. But otherwise, they kill people all the time, and they always have, and they're killing somebody right now. And their excuse, oh, he had a gun, is actually not true. If you go and look at the Washington Post report, and only this year has the Washington Post decided to actually really do a good job investigating this, and they actually have done some pretty good work on it. But they say, yeah, you know, about half of these people had weapons. Maybe it was a little bit more than half had weapons. But in hardly any of them, as they describe them, would I believe, you know, presumption of innocence and all, would I even suspect that these people meant to harm a cop? Just because somebody has a gun in their hand doesn't mean they're trying to kill a cop with it. For God's sake, man. And of course, a lot of these weapons weren't even firearms and, you know, distances unknown. Point of bullet entry unknown. But, you know, there was one here in North Austin a couple of years ago where, old white guy in his 70s, I think. Perhaps he was a bit confused or something. He called the cops. I think it was he thought he was being burgled or something. He heard something. He called the cops. The cops came. He met them in his driveway with a gun in his hand. The cops are screaming, pointing his gun at him, screaming, drop it, drop it, drop it. The old man is too startled and confused and can't even, you know, doesn't even have a moment to explain to the idiot cop, no, idiot, I'm the one who called you. It's you and me against the bad guy, stupid. Before the cop kills him to death. This happens all the time. And there are hardened criminals, serious hardened criminals, who would never kill a cop. Kill a cop? Hey, man, that's criminally stupid. And yet these cops act like the average Joe is just looking for a chance to plunge a knife in his throat or whatever. It's completely ridiculous. Remember the one on the show a few weeks back where the guy was riding a horse-drawn carriage. He was like taking people on a horse-drawn carriage ride. And the cop pulled him over, said he didn't have a reflector. And of course, who do you think escalated the thing? And give me a break. The cops are the guilty ones in all of these. The cop aggresses against the guy. Who knows if a muscle flexed in resistance whatsoever or not. And the cop killed him. Said, oh, he's trying to kill me. He was not trying to kill you. You picked a fight with him. You're a murderer. That's what the cops are. They're murderers. And I know you love them, but the reason that you love them is because you watch CSI whatever all day. Law and Order. Twice a day. Four times a day. All day. Every day. For 25 years straight. Dun dun. Where would we ever be without the cops to love us so much, even more than our mommies and our daddies do? Dun dun. Oh, the cops, they're happy to admit when they're wrong and let the innocent guy go and move on to the real suspect. Because, you know, why wouldn't they be? Dun dun. Oh yeah, the prosecutors and the cops, they mean so well, and the judges would never let them get away with doing the wrong thing, which they would never try to do anyway. And of course, you know, all those poor brown people on the poor brown part of your town would all come and get you and come and take all your stuff away if it wasn't for them. Bum, bum. All day, every day you love them. But the truth isn't on the TV dramas. The truth is in your Facebook feed. The truth is on Keegan Steffens' Twitter role there. And you just go and look. And here's what a cop is, okay? A cop is a guy who likes murdering people and thinks murdering people is fun. And I know you think that sounds a little extreme because you're not ruthless. And so you think, well, geez, did I really hire a bunch of ruthless killers to be my security force? I'm not sure. Are some people ruthless in the world? I guess maybe they are, kind of. Some people take joy in killing people? Yeah. In fact, Keegan Steffen is going to talk about a video that just hit the internet a couple of days ago of San Francisco cops on tape at a donut shop, film with the customer's phone, talking about how fun it is to kill people and the trials and tribulations of trying to kill people with a body cam and still get away with it. And they're laughing about it. Because that's their job, finding an opportunity to kill someone and get away with it. And they almost always get away with it. You know, a black friend of mine the other day asked me, why? What is it with all the killings of the black people all the time? I don't get it. And I told him, well, I think you'd agree with me that the cops themselves individually aren't necessarily racist. And that was a long time ago, man, where people, I mean, there are a lot of them who are, but I'm just saying they're not uniformly a bunch of racists. You know, most white people are politically correct. If you ask a murderer cop, Black Lives Matter, he will say, yes, of course Black Lives Matter. And then he'll turn around and kill a black guy. Why? It's not because he hates black guys. It's because it's easier to get away with killing black guys. That's why. Because black guys have less political connections, which means the chances of any accountability are diminished, you know, beyond what they are for killing anybody else, which is already pretty low. That's the answer. Pretty simple. They like killing people. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. I like being a radio show, man. It's all right. Hey, listen, let me tell you about how to support the show for a minute here. This is not going to take the whole segment or anything, I swear. But if you go to scotthorton.org, which, by the way, we're going to have a new and improved scotthorton.org soon. I think it is being voluntarily improved soon. ScottHorton.org. That's my website. I got 3,900 something interviews going back to 2003 for you there. Plus the whole show archives going back at least a couple of years. I used to be kind of shy about posting on my whole show archives. I still got folders full of them, but yeah, maybe someday. Anyway, here's how you can help support the show. You can do monthly donations by way of PayPal. 5, 10, 20 bucks, whatever you like, perfectly fine. Tom Woods does 100 bucks a month because he loves the show that much. David Beto, too. Two all-time libertarian greats. They support the show. You can do that. I sure do like that. And there are a couple. There's one guy that does one penny a month. There's another guy that does, I think, a dollar. There are quite a few fives. Those are great, man. I'm happy. I mean, if all of you donated a penny, that'd be better than just the one guy donating the one penny. But even that is cool with me, you know, whatever, dude. Adds up. Help take care of them PayPal fees. Anyway, so that's the monthly donation things. Also, you can just do one-off donations, and you don't need a PayPal account to do the single donations off your credit card or debit card or whatever you want. If you, and I'm just Scott Horton, or Scott at scotthorton.org on PayPal, of course. If you just go to scotthorton.org/donate, you can find all this stuff. And here's the deal. Anybody who donates $100 to the show, you either get a silver QR code commodity disc, which has no face value inscribed on it, but tells you the instant spot price when you scan it with your phone, which is, I think, the greatest currency ever invented by mankind. In this case, my friend Arlo Pignatti. Or you can get a copy of Your Money or Your Life Against the Income Tax by Sheldon Richman, or you can get Red and Blue and Broke All Over by Charles Goyette, or you get the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, or you can get Beyond Democracy, Why Democracy Does Not Lead to Solidarity, Prosperity, and Liberty, but to Social Conflict, Runaway Spending, and a Tyrannical Government, narrated by the great Jeff Riggenbach. For free, as your free gift from us to you. And then check this out, especially for you audio junkies podcasting these things or listening live, whatever, you're into that. Anyone who donates $200 or more to the Scott Horton Show gets a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think Audio, libertarian audiobooks. They've already got a couple of dozen of them, and they plan on doing hundreds more. And you will get every audiobook that they've ever done, including The War State by Mike Swanson, including Liberty and Eclipse by Will Grigg, and many other great ones, this Beyond Democracy one. And you donate $200, you get every audiobook that Listen and Think Audio has ever done or will ever do. And in fact, Derek said, Derek Sheriff, the guy that runs Listen and Think Audio, you can pass on your lifetime subscription to your kin. He doesn't care. It's a subscription forever. Not even a lifetime subscription, a forever subscription to free libertarian audiobooks from Listen and Think Audio. And that's for anyone who donates $200 or more to the show. So if you like having a show to listen to, then you probably know somewhere in your brain, they're like, oh yeah, I guess he probably needs money in order to be alive and do this for a living and stuff, because a living, Say's Law and all that kind of. I produce so that I can consume, you understand? So, scotthorton.org/donate if you'd like to help support things like this. All right, good. Now, and isn't that cool, Derek Sheriff? $200 to me, and then he gives you a lifetime subscription. So, anyway, if you're into audiobooks, man, take him up on that, would you? All right, good. Cool. All right, so now, real quick, it's electoral politics, but it's big electoral politics. It's really worth covering here. Sanders is now cleaning Hillary Clinton's clock in Iowa. Where the hell is it? Can't read this. You know, the real clear politics, they have all the polls, but I never can tell what the hell I'm looking at. Iowa, Republican. No, Iowa Democrat. Where is it? Iowa. Oh, Iowa Democrat. Sanders, 43. Clinton, 33. Biden, 10. O'Malley, 5. Webb, 1. Chafee, 1. Sanders up 10 in Iowa. Now, you know, the thing of it is, though, Iowa, it's a caucus state, and it's very much Democratic Party establishment. And, you know, remember when they all walked in there, I was the only one saying that John Kerry was going to be the winner in Iowa in 2004. And then, yeah, hey, he's the electable one. We got to do what's responsible here. Bernie Sanders with his crazy socialism and his wild hairdo. He's not electable. And which, by the way, is this not the greatest joke the Democratic Party has ever played on itself? Convincing themselves that Hillary Clinton is electable? No wonder there's such a push finally to try to bring Biden in. They're just figuring out. Because their ideology says, oh yeah, you know, identity politics and feminism and this and that and first woman president and this and that. And they are so stuck on those mantras, they've been unable to recognize that. You know what? People just don't like Hillary Clinton because, you know what? She's not likable enough. At all. Surprise. Anyway, yeah, I saw there was an article today where all our campaign people are pointing the finger at each other and at her. And say, well, we keep trying to tell her not to do the stupid thing, and then she keeps doing stupid things anyway. Well, that's good. Anyway, so that's the big news. Sanders up 10 in Iowa, and then in New Hampshire, Democrat. Sanders 52, up 22 in New Hampshire. Up 22, 52 to Clinton's 30. Biden 9, Webb and Chafee nothing, O'Malley 1. That's the Democratic primary 2016 as it's shaping up right now. Wow. Isn't that something? So I guess Biden is definitely going to go in there seeing that much weakness on Hillary's part, but obviously being able to recognize how weak Sanders is as a general election candidate. Come on. And, you know, it's crazy because I've been saying that, come on, man, you know, Donald Trump, he's going to burn out here pretty soon and then it's going to get back to Jeb, right? Sort of that same thing with John Kerry in 04. Iowa caucuses, come on. Who's electable? Is Donald Trump really electable in the general election? And then that's where they pick the centrist establishment guy, right? But then the Republicans in Iowa, Bush has 3. Trump 29, Carson 25, Cruz 10, Walker 5, Fiorina 4, Rubio 6, Bush 3% in Iowa right now. That's really something to see, man. Not that any of these people are better than the others, but just funny to see how the establishment candidates are hurting so bad. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'm Scott. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I gotta write something down so I remember to say later on. Yeah, it's the Scott Horton Show. I'm here live on the Liberty Radio Network, noon to 2. On the weekdays here, libertyradionetwork.com, LRN.FM. And our first guest on the show today is our good friend Joshua Hughes, the peace seeker, American expat, now living on his sustainable farm down in Costa Rica. How's it going, Joshua? Good to talk to you again.
It's going great, Scott. I'm glad
good,
to be
good.
On.
Oh, I need to turn you down and put my headphones on here. Let me see. All right. Hey, man. So, yeah, good to talk to you again. My first question is, has the raffle winner, because as everybody remembers, right, I should say, we did a raffle. We raffled off a vacation down to Joshua Hughes's permaculture farm down there in Costa Rica. And John Cornish won the raffle here live on the show. And he told me that I should reassure the audience that they should know that, one, he's a hardcore listener to this show going back for years and years and years. And two, he's really interested in what you're doing down there and wants to learn all about it, not just sit in the hammock by the river and all that. So, so that everybody should feel really good about him winning and them not. But so how's that going? Have you talked to him? Has he already gone down there and these kinds of things?
He hasn't come down yet. I did speak to him, and I'm looking forward to seeing him. I hope he comes down in the summertime, so there'll be a lot more people here to engage with. Right now, we've been really busy planting. There's only a few of us here, but we're planting lots of trees. So it's not the normal time of the year when people come down in October because it's really rainy, but it's a great time for planting. So I think I'll see him in a few months.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I guess spring comes early down there, right?
Well, we have we kind of have eternal spring. It's just we have dry and wet times. So right now we're coming into our very, very wet time this next month or so. We'll probably get 15, 20 feet of rain in the next 6 weeks.
Cool. All right. So, you know, I hope you've got good drainage. That water, it can pile up pretty quick, man, for a liquid. You know what I forgot to do
is that's one of the reasons. Actually, a very important part of what we do here is we're learning how to keep the rain in the hills because it's running away too fast right now without all the trees and stuff that used to be here. So, it's a big part of what motivated me to get into what we're going to speak about today.
Okay, cool. Well, first, let me tell them that I'm sorry I didn't say in the first place that the website is verdeenergia.org. Only there's just the one E in the middle. They share the E there, the two words, verdeenergia.org. And so now tell us, what is all this about? Why you want to save all that water in the hills and mountains?
Well, when I got here, I did buy a farm in an area that was very destroyed, very deforested. I did move down here to just buy an existing forest and call it, you know, like I did something just because I spent some money. I needed to do something and really practice and see what we could pull off. So we bought an area called the Puriscal area. This is a little county that we live in. And it's one of the most deforested areas in the country. And it's actually, maybe 10 years ago, was talked about in National Geographic as one of the worst forestry plans in the world. About 50 years ago, we had maybe 60 years ago, a primary forest here where I live. And since then, it's become pure cattle and tobacco. And now, tragically, it's all being burnt and cut down for palm oil, which... I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard little bits about palm oil or what's going on around the world, but it's really destructive. And it's not like it's curing cancer on the other side of things. It's making people sick. So it's a product here that's making the jungle sick. It's centralizing wealth into very big corporations' hands that are buying up the property down here, raising the property values so locals can't afford to stay on their land, and not really helping with the forestry issues by planting trees, although the government calls it reforestation, even though they're doing it just to exploit it. So yeah, I've seen that happening, and just in the last week, I've been driving around and taking notes of how many farms around me how much jungle is being burnt to the ground right now as we speak, 10 minutes from my house, to put in palm. So that's become sort of one of my missions over the last year, is just to is to help stop that, to help stop the inflation of the land costs here so locals can afford to be here.
And how do you stop?
Well, what we've been doing is we've been putting together collectives and buying chunks of land that are destroyed cattle land. And we've been doing reforestation projects. But over the years, I started here.
In other words, you talk too fast. That's an important thing there. You're conserving land by just buying it up. That'll keep it out of their hands. You're not lobbying the local government to take it over and make it a park or some kind of thing. You're doing it yourself.
No, and I've just done a lot of research in the last years on what national parks and stuff mean. And while I do support that because it saves it, a lot of that was done at the cost of indigenous folks around the world. And I just read some terrible things about John Muir and eugenics and what these guys did when they started national parks. So I'm not into that model. I want a model that comes from the bottom up. And it's very personal out here because as they burn or cut, locals lose drinking water. We lose our roads and we lose our local economy.
And now this isn't just you and your gringo friends coming in and doing this to the locals. This is you working with them?
Yes, I've been finding people that want to stay on their land and helping finance or fund building, changing and evolving their land into something more useful. Because so far, the locals here have just been taking care of cattle for Burger King or McDonald's. That's what they do. Or growing tobacco for Philip Morris. They haven't done much for themselves with this land at all. Mostly due to the free trade deals and the things that come into this country and force the price of food down so drastically that I can't grow tomatoes and compete with Walmart. It's madness. I'd just be a slave to my land. So we had to really figure out how to create some kind of cottage industry that could come, that could help regenerate while it was creating, you know, wealth for the people in our neighborhoods. And so most of our projects are about 30-40% locals and 60-70% people from all over the world.
And what all are you planting instead of palm oil trees or whatever? Is it just palm trees is what they plant for the oil? I don't know anything
about that. Yeah, they're just doing this African palm, which they turn into hydrogenated oil that fills up pretty much every product on your shelf up there. And another word for hydrogenated oil in my mind is just cancer. it's not a good product. And out here, it's a monoculture that they spray lots of chemicals on. And worse than that, we're removing massive amounts of forest every few seconds in the world. I think we remove something like 40 football fields of forest a minute. So this is a real – it's not just the products they're making and what they're choosing to make. It's that they're destroying our air, our water filters here. And
I can see how replacing a real rainforest with a bunch of palm trees is not quite the same thing.
No, all the animals leave. It becomes an acidic – the soil becomes acidic, so nothing local will grow ever again. And they spray a lot of Monsanto products on the forest down here to get rid of it and to replace it with these things. So they're stealing all our nutrients. Every acre of that oil, of those trees creates something like 10,000 gallons of oil a year, which is very attractive to people from outside the country. So they're taking all of our energy literally from the soil and selling it to people all over the world. And again, if this was curing cancer, I couldn't complain, but this is causing cancer, so I'm complaining. And I've lost three neighbors to cancer in the last year, under 40 years old, three young, healthy people from the water being tainted from all these toxins, you know. And we wouldn't even have these things if we didn't steal them from the UAE and Dubai and Sudan and all these places. So the way they're even getting these products to grow here is by putting very toxic products all over our land. In Costa Rica is now the highest use of pesticides and herbicides per acre in the world. We just passed China and the U.S. And it's not because we're eating it here. It's because we're shipping it there. So every time you eat a palm product, just know that a jungle is disappearing right next to me.
Man, so, that's amazing to think, comparing just mind's eye, the land area of Costa Rica is, what, like half the size of the Texas Panhandle or something like that?
Yeah, like Connecticut. The size of
Oh, yeah. So much smaller than the Texas Panhandle. When we get back, we're going to talk more about what's going on down there in Costa Rica and what Joshua Hughes is doing about it and what you can do to take part too. VerdeEnergia.org. They share an E in the middle there. VerdeEnergia.org. We'll be right back in a sec. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, eye on the empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Okay, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Joshua Hughes. He's a refugee from the collapse of the American Empire, now living down there in Costa Rica, and owns a farm down there. And so we're talking about how the big corporations are coming around, buying up all the land, raising cattle and tobacco and driving up all the prices and bankrupting all the locals, forcing them off of their land. And, and how he bought his own farm, his own property, right in the middle of this devastation, basically, wrought by, people have very little interest in, what kind of disaster they leave behind them when they go. And so, we were just getting to the part about what in the hell you're really doing about it.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you put it that way, Scott. It helps. And I really can't stress enough how those free trade deals do affect people. And while guys like Trump want to call people that come from my part of the world down here rapists and drug dealers, we're actually farmers escaping from his clutches and trying to find a living somewhere in the world. So anyway, I'll segue into what I want to talk about, the positive side. I've been terrified of how dollars work. And you talk about this a lot, about our lack of sovereignty with our capital in the U.S. and how the Federal Reserve and these banksters control our lives. And people are always talking to me about how they're going to save money or invest here or whatever, but they typically do it still in dollar denominations. And since the Federal Reserve, I think dollars have lost, what, like 97% of their value? So we've experienced a complete collapse in the last 100 years. And as we're about to hit the bottom, people are asking me if I think it's going to go down. I find that amusing. It goes down. It's gone down my entire life. I can't afford anything that I bought when I was born in, 1977. We're in a different world with the dollar. So I had to start figuring out a way I could save my energy differently. I didn't want to work my whole young life, save it in cash, and then in 30 years it's worth 3 times less or 50% as much. That's not okay. So, and especially while I'm subsidizing my own demise by paying taxes to these corporate, I don't want to use the word. So what we've done is we've started collectives where we are buying land, like I said, in collaboration with local folks that want to stay on their land. So, for example, this farm we're doing right now, I had 3 out of the 9 owners in this family that own this land for the last 80 years want to stay owning it. But the other 6 can't because they're desperately in need of some funds. So we found friends and people that want to do this to help invest in the land. We're replanting it. The plan to take about 1 out of 10 of the trees eventually eventually we will have lumber from part of the land. Eventually we will have cacao and production of local species. But that's just what we can do here in Costa Rica. So we're producing a lot of great high-end medicinals and a lot of trees for our future. Like 20, 30 years from now, what we saved in dollars and put into trees now will be worth 30, 40 times as much. And it will adjust up with inflation. I actually am not afraid of inflation if I'm in the resource economy. So I've really been pushing to get out of dollars and into a local resource-backed currencies. And the way we're doing it here and all over the world, I have friends in Texas, California, Washington, Oregon, New York that are all doing this locally too, where they live. And there's a bunch of different ways to do it, but forests are kind of the key, because there is some support from the governments of the world if you do want to get some subsidy. But I've been trying to do it from the bottom up again. I don't really like being beholden to big governments. So it seems to be working, and we've done it on 2 farms already and succeeded. So we're going into our 3rd farm. Now wait a minute.
What's working? You're saying you're planting the trees, but you also have already created a local currency based on the value of the trees? Is that it?
Based on the value of a lot of the products we create, because trees are a little longer term. But what I've been doing is using something that's a little example. I grow a pig, or I grow yuca, a nice potato, like a tuber. and I grow hectares of this, acres of yucca. My neighbor has a pig. We've worked this out over the last 10 years to where we trade, but a little more officially than just a handshake and trade something right then. That's kind of how currencies were created, right? You couldn't carry a whole pig around and trade off little pieces. So we've created a local currency, which we're starting to keep track of. Hopefully, I've got a friend working on this in the way that Bitcoin does with the blockchain technology. That's what I really want to work towards as this grows. But so far, it's been a very local approach. And we trade out yucca for pig, and I don't have the yucca yet. I'm going to have it in months. Well, if my yucca crop fails, I've got trees to back my local trades. So I can chop a tree down if I have a failure. And trees are much more resilient to the shifts in climate, which we're experiencing drastically here, by the way. Trees are a solid way not only to be resilient against the climate change, but to actually help create weather, because trees and mountains that are full of forest make better weather, more consistent. So I've been doing this, and in the long term, we're talking about millions of dollars worth of wealth to be created off every 50, 60-acre farm. This isn't just a hippie ideal. We've been doing this and attracting a lot of people that come from all spectrums of the political, you know, all sides of the political spectrum. So I'm finding this is a nice way to marry that desire to keep the wild and the nature and everything around us and the forest alive, but also that need to feed our children, to know that 10, 20 years from now, when you maybe can't work as hard as you do now, that you can enjoy life, and that you don't spend the rest of your life toiling in the fields to compete against Walmart. So it's not only been a great answer for the farmers, it's a great answer for people that want to withdraw legitimacy from Wall Street and put their money into something very real. So I've been helping my friends do that, and it's been working wonderfully. We've got two farms that have been functioning for years and a new one coming online now. And a few more in Oregon that are going to be starting very soon. So. Uh-oh, can you hear me?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sitting here asking a question into a dead mic.
I got you.
Yeah,
I got you back. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm an idiot. Well, I didn't form my question very well, so it's a good thing my mic wasn't on. Hey, listen. So my question is, what all does the term permaculture imply?
Okay, well, we've taken what it really means, like a permanent culture shift. It's not like agriculture. Agriculture was just kind of a way to suck value out of land. I haven't really been impressed with capitalism lately. So I'm big into the taking a local approach at everything, observing what is going on around you, seeing what the needs are, and then addressing them in a way that does no harm to other people. You try not to steal. And these are lessons we all probably got taught, but when we get out into the business world, we don't count externalities in. So permaculture is begging us to count externalities as part of the equation. And when you do that, you have to start changing a lot of things. Now I can't just sell tomatoes at the market, because again, I'm competing against Walmart slaves. Literally, they make $1.50 an hour here to work for Walmart. So I can't do that. So I have to reinvent. Permaculture forces me to reinvent the whole way I think about getting a product to market. So now I make ketchup instead of sell tomatoes. And you sell direct through farmers markets or CSAs, community supported agriculture projects. But permaculture doesn't stop at the farm. It goes into your house and how you deal with your garbage, if you even want to make garbage anymore. I'm actually a believer there is no such thing as garbage, because I've been in the recycling industry my whole life, and it's all valuable. We just didn't think about it for a long time. Yeah. So permaculture is forcing us to address all these issues and kind of mimic nature. And in mimicking nature, I'm finding why it's succeeding with much less resistance. I don't have to push so hard, because my economy and everyone around me, they all get in line with it, because it's comfortable and they agree with it, and it fixes things. It doesn't just take. And it's a way to protect ourselves from the worldwide economy that is so erratic right now and not going to be doing any better anytime soon.
Yeah. So let me ask you, as a devil's advocate position here, because all this sounds like actually kind of fun, man. I wouldn't mind living on a farm down in a rainforest and all this kind of stuff. It sounds really cool. Yeah. But on the other hand, I mean, it sounds like maybe some things are being conflated I mean, well, not necessarily. We do live in a society here in the U.S. where we do have a central bank and we do have, you know, the biggest government, the most corrupt government probably in the history of mankind, and this kind of thing going on. So it is sort of all part and parcel. I understand why to leave it. But it also seems like what you're leaving behind is a much finer division of labor and specialization. And it sounds sort of like really what you're doing is, you know, you're escaping this economy, but you're rewinding a lot of economic progress too, almost back down to the level of barter. So doesn't that really harm your standard of living? And, you know, like you mentioned, somebody gets sick with cancer. Well, who's around to treat it? That kind of thing.
Well, in the country I'm in, Costa Rica, we have an amazing medical system, and it's very inexpensive. We have a functioning insurance system. We have control over the cost of medical care here, unlike Obamacare, where we turned it all over to Medicare or all over to Blue Cross Blue Shield. So we've got a country here that's functioning a little different, but not everybody has to do the same thing. It only takes about one farmer out of 20 people to feed people in an organic fashion. So I have people here that do nothing but work on the website development because that's what they specialize in, and they help us do that. And so it's not just about all being farmers. I didn't come here to be a farmer for the rest of my life. I came here to do the jobs and learn them so I could have a realistic approach at creating an economy from the bottom up. So this for me has been a very powerful lesson in people getting to learn every part of their corporation, getting to learn every part of their business, getting to learn every part of production. And I know when I was in the professional world in the U.S., my boss at the top, who was golfing all day, had no idea what was going on in the warehouse, had no idea the struggles. So really, it's just about me. For me personally, it's been about getting down and, you say, cutting my lifestyle back. I eat better organic food every day than I ever have in my life, even when I made $150,000 a year. I have more leisure time than I ever had then, and I still get everything I need in the world. So it's been a cut. In the beginning, it was definitely a backtrack because I really didn't know what to do. I didn't know the word permaculture when I got here. I just knew I hated war, and I knew I hated slavery. And I knew I would not keep supporting Israel and the U.S. military at all, you know, just because I needed to work. So, by the way, this should be happening everywhere in the U.S. I don't want everybody to run away. In fact, I want people to hunker down in their neighborhoods and start building biodigesters right now, turning all of their local poo into gas so they don't have to buy any gas from Dubai or send pipelines through Syria. So we can create the local products we need without spending the money, and then we can earn less money if we choose. So I, you know, make my own cooking gas. I don't spend that much money anymore. I can make less. It's been a nice exchange. But set into an economy like the U.S., if you applied this idea, which is happening all over the place, like I said, CSAs, Community Supported Agriculture, is one of my most exciting, one of the most exciting things I can see happening in the U.S. is food production is becoming local. People are back to talking to their farmers, and we're rebuilding this old economy from the ground up. Because we talk about this a lot on your show, about how it's kind of how Wall Street is now the economy somehow. Like people relate to the Dow as like how well things are. Well, the Dow's skyrocketed over the last 20 years, and most people I know are doing terrible financially. So I don't know. It's kind of relative. And you know, the TV life in America isn't the real life. Most of my friends are commuting most of the time or stressing about debt. So one of the big things that we do here is we really work hard not to get into debt. And that's because we take a different approach. Yeah. Growing how we can, not getting ahead of ourselves.
Right.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, Joshua, listen, your internet connection is getting bad on us and we're over time here too. So it's time to wrap it up. But I want to thank you again for coming back on the show. I'll tell everybody when we get back, the live audience will hear again, the name of the website. But for everybody listening to the recording later, it's verdeenergia.org. Verdeenergia.org. You learn all about what they're doing down there, at Verde Energia Pacifica. At the great, Joshua Hughes, great permaculture farm down there and all that they're about. And there's a lot going on, that we were not able to cover even on the show today. So, please go and check that out if you guys have the interest. VerdeEnergia.org. And, I'll thank you very much, but also, give you the last word here too, if there's anything important you needed to say.
Oh, just, thank you again, Scott. And I'm excited to keep spreading this message and, regaining like a local sovereignty again. It's very important to me. And thank you for spreading the message again on your show.
Right on. Well, appreciate everything, dude. Take care.
Yeah. Ciao.
Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Oh, man, that sounds terrible to me. All right, chat room guys say it sounds okay now. Hey, Ian, if you can hear me, it's all messed up, man. It sounds like a bunch of packets got lost. It could be me. I had a modem problem earlier today. Dang dumb modem. Although, all these computers look like they're not having a problem like that. I think it is an LRN problem. But anyway, whatever, dude. I don't care. Can you guys hear me all right? Tell me, chat room, if you can hear me all right, and then I won't care. Yeah, man. So, unfortunately, Skype problems. Oh, Skype problems. You're such a problem, Skype. See, kids, Skype sounds better than a phone, but it's so much less reliable. Like in this case, I don't have this guy's phone number. I have his Skype name. But apparently, his Skype hasn't given him an opportunity to accept my request. And so, maybe or maybe I won't talk to him today. I don't know. Damn. We were going to talk about the cops. Oh, you know what? Good. Perfect opportunity for me to talk about the cops. One benefit of Skype is that if he does come online in the middle of the segment, no problem. I don't have to call him. I just click a button and bring him right on in the middle of the segment. So, right? I totally forgot about this story, but then I remembered it again the other day when I was telling it to somebody. And that's, oh, I probably told you guys this before. But hey, I've been doing this for a decade or so straight, and so sometimes I say the same things. But anyway, here's what happened. I saw a documentary on the Learning Channel or one of those kind of things, the Discovery Channel, whatever type deal. And it was about how in the 1970s there were two movies. No, back up. Prior to this, in the movies, the cops were always the bad guys. And the anti-hero was always the hero. Then in the, well, pretty much. Then in the 70s, they came out with two movies. The French Connection with Gene Hackman and Dirty Harry with Clint Eastwood. And in both of those, it's a bad guy law-breaking cop who is the hero and who must break the law because the law is for wimps and is letting bad people get away with things and whatever. And so the law enforcers, of course, must be immune from it. And then, so whatever, who cares? A couple movies came out, right? But here's what happened. All of a sudden, Americans with their teeny tiny little brains that are so easy to manipulate decide they loved cops because of Gene Hackman and Dirty Harry. Gene Hackman and Clint Eastwood. And public attitudes about cops change. And yeah, there was a crime wave, this, that, whatever going on, they claim. But what really happened was the movies made such a powerful impression. And so, guess who noticed? The cop unions. And guess what they did? They took business trips to L.A. And they've been working this whole time to do everything they can to keep cops on TV and looking good on TV. And in movies as best they can. Because they're trying to control your mind. They're trying to make you love your enemies who hate you and are out to get you. And it works. Where would we ever be without them? That's the first thing people say when one proposes liberty. Hey, you know what's the most important thing? Liberty. Oh no, then what might happen? Better hire a lot of cops to prevent liberty from breaking out. Because something might happen. And mostly that's a bunch of crap. I think, you know, the first interview I ever did on this show, I actually did a couple of Waco interviews back on Say It Ain't So on Free Radio, but the first, when I started in 2003 doing the Philip Drew interviews on Chaos, the first one was Alan Bach from antiwar.com. And I asked him if he was an anarchist, and he goes, well, you know, I'm not too dogmatic about these things, and so I kind of flip back and forth a little bit, but, yeah, I am a libertarian, and I do have open eyes, and I gotta ask, you know, who do you think causes the most violence and disruption in our society? And I'm sorry, and that's just the end of the argument, isn't it? Is there any question? And people point to, you know, the mafia and the gangs and things like that, but those are all just black market protection rackets. All they are is governments, only on a lower level, protecting people who the government will not protect. And only wars against. And of course, you know, running protection for people participating in black markets that the government creates, like, you know, by banning gambling, banning prostitution, banning trade and consumption of drugs. Trade in and consumption of drugs, etc. But anyway, TV says... And you know what? Look at the theme behind Cops. Cops have been on the air for 25 years now or whatever. And the theme of every one of them, and they're very selectively edited, and it's been on so long that there's been great journalism about the show and how nothing that in their mind reflects badly on the cops ever makes it to air. It's a pure PR for the police at all times. But then it's hardly ever that they're catching a real bad guy, right? You ever watch Cops? I admit it's been a little while, but I try to watch it occasionally just to see if it's any different or whatever. It's been on so long. But every one of them, every time, it's just some loser. Like maybe a guy beating his wife or something, which, you know, hey, shouldn't assault people. That's a violent crime. But mostly it's just drug possession. Mostly it's just, you know, chasing people around all night for committing offenses. You know, prostitution stings and this kind of crap. And then the lesson that you're supposed to take from it is, well, those people are losers, and so, ha-ha, they deserve... You're supposed to laugh at them. They deserve whatever happens to them. Even when you might look at the same situation and go, wow, this girl has to go to jail now, and maybe prison, and God knows what the DA is going to do to her, really. Oh, they said she's on probation? Now they're going to revoke her probation? And she's going to get how much time for having a little bit of cocaine in her pocket or whatever it is. But you're supposed to watch and go, yeah, well, that's what you get for when the government says that you're not allowed to have any of that stuff. And you're supposed to take the side of power? Or at least if you identify with the helpless people that they're picking on, you're supposed to learn the lesson, as Bill Hicks taught it. State power will win, so don't try it. We will bust your house down. We will come after you. We will do to you whatever we feel like, and you can't stop us. Don't even consider it. So, you know, that's basically the deal. It's just like in Aldous Huxley wrote Brave New World Revisited. Did you ever read that one? Because, of course, Brave New World came out first, and that's where he says, you know, it's ruled by distraction and fun and drugs. And then came 1984, which is just pure totalitarian fear. And then, so Huxley wrote a thing where he kind of reviews his own book and Orwell's and then kind of adds to it and talks about, of course, modern American society is a perfect mixture of both, right? Where, you know, there's plenty of fun to be had, plenty of cold beer to drink and plenty of distraction. But if you want to stick your neck out, they will cut your head off. And there's plenty to be afraid of when it comes to that kind of thing. And in fact, that's what we're supposed to be talking about with Keegan Stephan right now, but we're having trouble making a connection with him, unfortunately. But, you know, one of these cases, in fact, I would beseech you to go and look at this footage. It's Natasha McKenna. And if you look at my Twitter feed today, twitter.com/ScottHortonShow, you can see the video that I posted there, and there's a couple of articles about her at Countercurrent News and a couple of other places. You know, this is a poor schizophrenic woman. She's already in jail. They got her locked in a cell. She can't hurt anyone. She's not hurting anyone. But then the cops are dressed up like some kind of goons out of a science fiction dystopia. It's incredible. They're wearing, you know, like they're the bad guys from the X-Files cleaning up after an alien abduction or something. You know, they got full white plastic mop gear on with these long, weird-looking gas masks. They look like something out of Star Wars. And then they kill her. They crush her to death and then blame it on her and all get away with it. Well, she had excited delirium, you see. That's what they call when a cop kills somebody. Excited delirium.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commoditydiscs. Commoditydiscs.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Ain't got any silly Skype problems, man, ruining my goddamn radio show. That's fine, though, man. I got things to talk about. Check out the spotlight today on antiwar.com. It's David Henderson on the economics of the draft. How many times have you heard that, you know what we need is a draft? That'll end the war. Especially liberals think that. Well, it was the draft that ended the Vietnam War. Yeah, because if you have a draft, then that means the rich and powerful will have to go fight, and then their rich and powerful parents will end the war so that their kids won't have to go fight. How many times have you heard that? In fact, there's some truth to the history of the more they got rid of the exemptions from being drafted into Vietnam, the more people... Huh? Ian, I can hear you. Yeah. Hi, how are you? Yeah? Am I not on? Check, check, check. I thought I was on. Let me see here. I can hear you. All right, let me... I will turn this off, and then I will turn this on. Oh, I gotta love that, man. All right, hang on now. Am I on now? All right, chat room guys, tell me if I'm on. Am I on? I'm sitting here trying to talk about things. Can you hear me? I'm doing a radio show. Hey, you know, it's a live radio show, so sometimes bad things happen on live radio shows, and no point in getting upset, man. It's a live thing. And, you know, sometimes technical troubles. These guys, oh, they replaced me with somebody else now? I'm not even on anymore? Oh, that's not good. What the hell? I can hear you, but can you hear me? Yeah, I'm ready. All right, y'all. So sorry about that, man. There was a problem with the technical difficulties being difficult and things like that, but I'm back. So, should be all okay. I hope. Anyway, so here's what I was saying. How many times... Oh, thanks. Fitzy G in the chat room says I'm back, so I'm back. How many times have you heard, especially liberals, say that we need a draft because that will help end the war? In fact, Charles Rangel has introduced bills like that repeatedly, right? And the theory goes that the draft ended the Vietnam War. And the theory goes that, yeah, if we have a draft, then the rich and powerful, their kids will get drafted, and then they'll have an interest in ending the war instead of just waging it all the time. And this kind of thing, right? You've heard that a million times. And you thought, well, maybe there's some plausibility to it. It does seem like when it's all quote-unquote volunteer, military that nobody else seems to have to worry about it too much and what's going on with the wars. And it is, I guess, historical that as the Vietnam War went on and the exemptions for being drafted into Vietnam were removed, to where now fathers and college kids and other people who were able to get out of it before had to go, then that ended up increasing the public pressure and the protest movement and that kind of thing. But is that good enough? Is that really all you need to know about it? I'm not so sure that that's all you need to know about it. And David R. Henderson, the great libertarian economist from the Hoover Institution at Stanford, right? I think. Yeah. Well, it's been a while. Anyway, capitalist comes, and he, you know what? He teaches graduate school to naval officers. I forget. The Monterey Naval Postgraduate School. He teaches economics to the Navy. That's who he is. And he writes The Wartime Economist. It's been a while, but he writes The Wartime Economist at antiwar.com. And he's got the spotlight today. Would conscription make war less likely? And so he takes into account all of those, you know, slogans and bromides and opinions you've heard about why a draft would be good for ending wars, and he completely nukes them off the face of the earth. Wrong, wrong, wrong. And horrible and evil and immoral, even if it was right anyway, it would still be wrong. Never mind being incorrect. Incorrect, incorrect, incorrect. But even if it was correct, it would still be wrong. That's what I meant to should have said in the first place. Hey, cool. Keegan Stephens' thing is now green. Okay, well, I'm going to call him at the bottom of the hour now because there's just no time. Okay, I'll call you back in 10. All right. So, yeah, anyway, please read David Henderson. It's a really important piece. Maybe you want to post it on your Facebook, tweet it out. Would conscription make war less likely? The answer is absolutely not. The answer is stop and think about it carefully for a minute, and you will know why. It's a faulty argument. Okay, so, oops, let's see here. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so there's that. I wanted to mention that. And then I got to mention David Vine today. David Vine has a piece at antiwar.com today called Garrisoning the Globe. Garrisoning the Globe. And you know who David Vine is? He is the inheritor of Chalmers Johnson's legacy on this issue anyway. I guess, you know, Tom Englehart and Nick Turse and David Vine are kind of divvying it up a little bit. Anyway, David Vine, in his great book, Island of Shame, about the American and U.S. screwing of the Chagossians of Diego Garcia and the grand theft of their property, basically. He has a section in there, I guess a chapter in there, the bases of the empire, that is just, you know, straight up picking up where Chalmers Johnson left off in describing America's garrisoning of the planet. And in fact, there's a great introduction by Tom Englehart where I think he very well captures Americans' ignorance of this. Most people have no idea that our government has 800 military bases in more than 130-something countries around the world. They just don't know that. And then if you tell them that, then immediately they start rationalizing. Well, they must be there for a reason, or else why would they be there? And the reason must be good enough, or else why would the democracy let it be that way? And so the whole thing is just a self-justifying perpetual motion machine. Why would any of this be happening if it wasn't what we, the people, had decided? Even though, I didn't know we had a world empire that dominated all of Eurasia and Africa and South America and all the seven seas and everything else. Garrisoning the Globe by David Vine. Read that. And then Patrick Coburn has a great one today about the Brits using a drone to execute, to assassinate British citizens in Syria. Drone strike them to death. And this is where America and England are now, 900 years after Magna Carta. Drone striking their own citizens. No charges. No treason trial in absentia, conviction and sentence or anything like that. Just an executive decision. Britain's drone executions are a mark of tyranny. says Patrick Coburn. And then he quotes from his brother Andrew Coburn's book about how ineffectual it is to do these decapitation strikes. It just makes matters worse, not better. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. All right, our next guest today is Keegan Stephan. You can find him at keegan.nyc. I didn't know that that was a thing. Keegan.nyc. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today. And I also want to direct everybody over to Keegan's Twitter feed, where he tweets, twitter.com/KeeganNYC, KeeganNYC. And you sure do a great job of keeping track of police violence against American civilians here. I've been following you for, I don't know, I guess about a year or so, and you're always very helpful in keeping me up to date, although I can't really claim I'm up to date, as up to date as I can possibly be. But I think there's just almost no keeping track of the amount of innocent people shot down by cops in this country. But anyway, I appreciate you joining us to try to cover them as best we can.
No problem. Glad to be here.
All right. So tell me, who's Natasha McKenna?
Natasha McKenna is a woman who was arrested. She was mentally ill. She was taken into a prison and detained. She was then killed by several police officers that went into her cell in full sort of hazmat gear. And her last words were, "You said you weren't going to kill me." And there's actually extremely brutal video of the whole encounter of the police approaching her in the cell and holding her down. It's really grisly and hard to watch.
Yeah, everyone listen to this for just 1 second here.
You promised you wouldn't kill me. I didn't do anything.
I've done it, lady. Where's the response? Go.
Which one do you want?
Dinner.
There you go, her last words. You promised you wouldn't kill me. I didn't do anything. And then it's the rapid reaction force thing, just like at Guantanamo Bay, where cell extraction team. And like you say, they're dressed up in this hazmat gear. It looks like, you know, mop gear from Desert Storm in 1991, back when Saddam Hussein actually still did have some chemical weapons that Ronald Reagan had given him.
Yeah.
And I imagine any person, but especially someone, you know, a paranoid schizophrenic being, you know, stomped and suffocated and murdered to death by guys dressed up like these monsters out of some paranoid schizophrenic nightmare of some dystopian totalitarian future. It's just crazy. Yeah. You can't look at that and think of any other thing other than some nightmare out of, you know, the Nazis or a science fiction movie or something.
Yeah, it definitely looks like a dystopian future, and it actually very much feels like it too. As the video goes on, you know, they hold her down, and even though she's just one woman and they have five officers holding her down, they proceed to tase her while she's held down, and they tase her four times in the video, and that ends up being the cause of death. They call it excited delirium, which is a term that has been proven to be manufactured by Taser, the company that produces these weapons, which they say are non-lethal, but have actually resulted in at least a dozen deaths in custody or during arrest that I've seen this year.
Yeah. And you think about that, too, just right there. Sorry to interrupt, but that would never work on anyone except a court system or a newspaper man that, hey, you know, if you electroshock, torture somebody to death, well, you know, there's a millisecond between the tasing and the dying, and so therefore the heart failed. Yep, that heart, it just up and failed, and it wasn't the taser that tased that heart to failure. It was the heart's fault. Excited delirium, the maybe could be argued as the reaction to being tased, but is some supposedly degree of separation between the tasing and the dying. I mean, what kind of load of crap is that?
Yeah, and, you know, Taser has spent a lot of money doing sort of scientific studies proving that the cause of death is excited delirium, and they actually will hire experts to go into court when officers are being sued for being sued or being tried for crimes for killing someone with a taser and say that, you know, argue that it's not the taser that killed them, arguing that it wasn't the fault of the officer that killed them, that it was this invented thing called excited delirium, which did not exist as a diagnosis until the taser, or at least it wasn't widely used. It was used like predating the 1920s, and then it disappeared from the vocabulary, and now it's back again and being used really widely in response to taser deaths.
Unbelievable. And seriously, everyone, please go and look at this footage. You can find it on Keegan's Twitter feed. You can find it on my Twitter feed this morning as well, /Scott Horton Show or /KeeganNYC. And it's brutal, but, you know, come on. I mean, actually, I guess you can't actually see her face when they're murdering her or whatever. There's so many people dogpiling on top of her. It's not the most gruesome thing. What's the most shocking about it? We see so many innocent people, especially blacks, murdered by cops. The most shocking thing about it is the costumes of the murderers in this one. We're like, where do these people get off? How do they convince themselves that this is how you attack a woman suffering from paranoid schizophrenia? And what are they doing?
Yeah, it's just baffling as to why they didn't have psychologists come in and like talk to her, try to remove her in a peaceful way, and instead decided to gear up. I really feel like it's an extension of the militarization of police forces, you know, even when they're handling our sort of most delicate Americans.
Yeah. Well, now, so these guys are all going on trial, right, for murdering this helpless woman?
No, they're pretty much all being exonerated before any sort of trial. The you know, the cause of death was listed as an accident, not even a homicide. They're pretty much getting off on the fact that it was, you know, caused by excited delirium and not by them holding her down and tasing her until her heart stopped.
Excited delirium. Amazing. Who's Felix Coomey?
I'm unfortunately not in front of a computer. Can you refresh me on the case?
Yeah, yeah. He's the innocent bystander in the gun control entrapment scheme there.
Yeah, so this is a case that's been really bothering me. You know, I'm local in New York City, and you know, so the police force that I watch sort of most closely is the NYPD, and so the NYPD was involved in a trying to purchase illegal handguns just north of the Bronx, actually, so in Westchester County, and the person that this officer had routinely bought guns from, he was buying them from again, and apparently the person who he had bought guns from got into the back of his car and threatened. Put a gun, what the officer said was a gun to his head, and took $1,400 cash from him and then fled from the vehicle. The cop then got out of the car and fired 14 to 20 shots, in this small town north of the Bronx. And he hit the perpetrator, who turned out not to even have a real gun. It was a fake gun. And he also shot, an innocent bystander, Felix Coomey, 2 times, in the chest, killing him. So obviously this is very disturbing use of force from an NYPD officer. There's actually, you know, a Supreme Court case that says officers are not allowed to fire at fleeing suspects, that it is a violation of their constitutional rights. And I think this case exemplifies why. You know, you're putting innocent bystanders at risk. You don't know what the actual threats are. If someone's fleeing, there are better ways to handle it. You know, that cop had a radio. There are cops all over. This is New York City.
Yeah.
You know, this could have been dealt with every other way besides shooting and injuring this person who, you know, ends up wasn't guilty of a violent crime and killing an innocent bystander who had children and grandchildren.
Yeah. You know, the thing is, too, is if they wanted to claim that, well, I don't think they could really claim this, that they thought he would be a danger to the general public just because he robbed a cop, an undercover cop, who he didn't know was a cop. That doesn't imply that he's, you know, about to go on a mass murder spree of innocent strangers or anything like that. But even if we accepted that argument and sure. he had to stop him, still, you don't shoot unless you have a clean shot. You don't spray exactly. 14 to 20 shots from a handgun down the street in New York City, for Christ's sake. This cop obviously was just throwing a temper tantrum is all.
Yeah, and you know, this it also brings up another point about police accountability in New York right now.
You know what? That's a perfect place to pick up this conversation on the other side. There's a very important questions there about accountability, and especially in New York. It's Keegan Stephan at Keegan.nyc. We'll be right back after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security: The Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm talking with Keegan Stephan about the police state. He's at Keegan.nyc, and you follow him on Twitter, twitter.com/KeeganNYC. Keeping up with police abuse and the Black Lives Matter movement and all that. So now, accountability. You said the magic word when we were going out to break there. And something a little bit different happened in New York recently, where the governor announced that he was going to appoint a guy who somehow there were going to be some independent investigations of at least some police killings, but then it seems like maybe that didn't pan out to be all what it was cracked up to be in the first place. I'm not sure. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, it's really heating up right now. So what happened was that there was a strong push from the Black Lives Matter movement, picking up on police accountability movements from the past, that had been asking for a special prosecutor to look into all police killings. So this would, you know, it would pick up these cases in which people are obviously concerned, rightfully, that local DAs who constantly work with the police on all sorts of other cases don't prosecute cases of cops killing people as critically as they could. You know, we've seen non-indictments across the country in cases where, you know, it looks very clear on video that someone is innocently killed by a cop such as Eric Garner. Governor Cuomo, to his credit, you know, brought this before the legislature and was trying to get a bill passed to create a special prosecutor, it's called, to prosecute all cases where the police kill New Yorkers. Unfortunately, it didn't pass. There was no bill passed. So he signed an executive order saying that the attorney general would take over all cases where police kill unarmed New Yorkers. So it was a bit of a compromise, only unarmed, and the term unarmed is undefined. But it was very clear on the fact that the AG would have to take over the investigation from local prosecutors anytime a cop kills an unarmed New Yorker. This got tested very quickly when one local prosecutor actually requested that the AG investigate a killing that happened 3 months before the bill was signed. Then we had Cuomo and the AG say that they were not going to investigate this case because the executive order was not grandfathered. It was only going to apply to cases that happened afterward. This was, you know, disappointing, obviously. And then the case we were just talking about, Felix Cumi, the innocent bystander that was killed by an NYPD officer, obviously fits the bill. This innocent bystander was unarmed. A local prosecutor is going to be taking up the case. And, you know, the AG should be taking it up. We should have a special prosecutor who's going to look into it, who doesn't have to work with the NYPD regularly. Unfortunately, the very next day after the shooting, the attorney general said that he would not be taking over the investigation, sort of mysteriously. And myself and some other people, you know, raised this objection. Why isn't he investigating? This is exactly what he's supposed to be investigating. And then Cuomo made an announcement sort of inexplicably augmenting his executive order, or disagreeing with his own executive order, saying that they would only be investigating when they thought that there was a conflict of interest. That's extremely disappointing. It seems like
another term without a definition there, or one that's malleable enough to.
Yeah. And I'm going to argue that it'll sort of be used exactly when it shouldn't be used.
Right.
So what's been happening ever since the executive order was signed is local DAs have been voicing their objections to the executive order, saying that they can handle their own cases. And, you know, you could argue that it's because they want to keep on good terms with their local police. And so anytime there's an objection, it looks like the AG is going to back off and not investigate. And those are the exact cases when he should be investigating, when there probably is a conflict of interest.
Yeah.
So it seems like this is sort of, this has not been, the greatest, move for accountability. We need a much stiffer law. And that is something that we're going to be pushing for this coming legislative session. They're going to have to, or there will probably be a proposal to pass a law that will replace the executive order. And we need to make sure that it is stronger in its language, that it defines all of these terms such as unarmed or eliminates that term entirely, and that it mandates that the AG absolutely has to investigate all of these killings and can't pick and choose and let local prosecutors stay on the case when it is a conflict of interest.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the thing. I was even talking with a friend of mine who's a lawyer who works with the state legislature here in Texas. And, you know, my idea was it should be automatic that not necessarily a special prosecutor at the state level, but just, you know, the state government has a system where a county district attorney from another county in the same state or parish or however it works in whatever commonwealth or whatever state people live in, but basically the same thing. You have from another district a prosecutor, and it's automatic. And I saw where actually there's kind of the – I forgot what it's called, the agenda action items that were put out by part of the Black Lives Matter movement, where they called for bringing in the FBI to investigate each one of these the way they do now when it's a suspected civil rights violation. And that seemed to me like the very kind of worst way to solve this. And that's, I mean, the FBI, these are the worst people in the whole wide world. You don't want them. What you want, though, is, like you're saying, a DA, a prosecutor, because, hey, you know, murder is a state crime. That's not a federal issue. It is a state issue. But there's this huge conflict of interest. And, of course, all you got to do is you just create a random lottery of state district attorney's offices. And then, you know, that district attorney has to appoint one of his assistant DAs to go and run the investigation. And then maybe, you know, you'd have to work out the details with the cops. But anyway, the point of my story is, I'm sorry, I'm trying to get to it, but I'm taking too long. My friend, the lawyer that works with the state legislature, says, yeah, we do stuff like this all the time. We have separate outside jurisdiction type investigations all the time. The Travis County government here in Texas has a special unit that's just for state level political corruption because it's the state government is in Travis County. So, and then he compared it to that and a few other things. So this is totally doable. This is totally doable. All we got to do is have our eye on the ball about what exactly the plan is, and asking the Justice Department to come and help is not the solution. You know, first we count how many black people were burned to death at Waco, and then we get back to asking the FBI for help.
Yeah. You know, I think what we've learned here in New York is that there's not only a conflict of interest when you have a local prosecutor looking into the police department they have to work with every day. You also have a conflict of interest every time you involve the political structure. So we really need to find a special prosecutor that is divorced from the political structure. So having the attorney general, the state attorney general, do it here is this political hotbed. You know, all politicians, they don't want to go against the police union. They don't want the police union upset about them. So they're also not doing the best job. And it was never the intent of the Black Lives Matter movement or the civil rights movement before them here in New York to have the AG be the special prosecutor. They wanted someone who was divorced from the political process. Mm-hmm. So when we're looking at this bill that might get drafted in the next legislative session, we also need to find out who that special prosecutor is and find out systems in which they can be divorced from the political system as well as the police department that they're investigating.
Yeah, man, we need to get also, and it would differ, it would have to differ state by state, but the lawyers really could work this out and get some real model legislation written for all 50 states that here's what we're going to do. Critical. Here's how we're going to solve it. And no well-meaning person on the other side could really object. I mean, it's not like cops everywhere have a real reason to mistrust the DAs from the next county over, do they? If they're not, you know, doing anything wrong, what do they have to worry about? But it'll make us feel better. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think there's no ends to what police unions will object to at this point. They've been objecting to every other level of accountability so far.
Yeah. All right. And now, so I'm sorry, in a couple minutes here, I want to kind of get back to the list here a little bit. I'm glad we talked about that though, because that's the most important part of this is, you know, the actual accountability and all that. But can you tell us about some more of these people who were killed by the cops? I got this whole list here from going down your Twitter feed. It's hard to keep track of them. Well, tell me about the two skaters that got shot by a cop. We're supposed to believe they were trying to beat him to death with their skateboards in Olympia, Washington. Is that it?
Yeah. I mean, it's called the Olympia shooting. If you want to learn more about it, you can definitely get a lot of information by searching the hashtag Olympia shooting. And yeah, it happened in Washington. Two black stepbrothers, allegedly, stole beer from a store. They actually left it there and then were, you know, leaving, apparently going home, but a police officer pulled over seeing them and, on the side of a highway, engaged them and shot them both. And the cop says that they were threatening him with a skateboard. There is no accusation that they made any contact with him with the skateboard, and yet he shot them, both of them. And the DA announced last week, I believe it was, that he was not going to press any charges against the officer for shooting them. No excessive force charge, no reckless endangerment charge, nothing. But that he was going to charge both of the brothers for assault with a deadly weapon. And he argued that the skateboard was a deadly weapon. So, obviously double standard of justice there, it feels like.
Well, at least they're still alive so that I guess eventually they'll be able to tell their side of the story. Something tells me it's not going to sound too much like what the cops are saying here. All right. Listen, I'm sorry we're out of time. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I hope we can do this again soon, Keegan.
Absolutely. Thank
you. All right, y'all. That is Keegan Steffen. He's at Keegan.nyc and follow him on Twitter / KeeganNYC. Thanks for listening, y'all. See you tomorrow.